Hello, I'm Shelley George, and this is the very first instalment of Nucleus Wealth's new podcast, Nucleus Wealth in Power. This podcast will be a bit different to our big brother Nucleus Investment Insights, in that I'll be aiming to provide you with some thought-provoking ideas for your finances, no matter where you are in your wealth journey. A passion of mine has always been a curiosity about what philosophers as far back as Socrates have called the good life. Given how long philosophers have been pondering this, I don't hold much hope of answering it, but I'm certain the search for it will unveil some interesting insights about finance, given finance is so inextricably linked to our lives. Given it's the first episode, I'd like to start by introducing myself. I'm head of operations at Nucleus Wealth. This means I'm responsible for making sure all the areas outside research, portfolio construction, and financial advice are doing what they need to be doing. Before I joined Nucleus Wealth, I spent the last decade working for the likes of AMP and Australian Super. Among my many roles, I dealt across asset classes and global markets, set up the global multi-asset dealing capability for Australian Super as it internalised its asset management, and was a small cap Australian equities analyst. But outside work, on weekends and evenings, you'll mostly find me being active. I love running, salsa, swimming, mountain biking, camping, and being outside. And if I can manage to sit still long enough, I also enjoy having a bit of a read. So before I jump into the show today, I'd like to kick off with an acknowledgement of country. So in the spirit of reconciliation, Nucleus Wealth would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respect to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Okay, so to the first show, what are we actually going to be looking at? I am lucky enough to have my colleague Tim Fuller here, who's going to help me go through some of the different characteristics of superannuation investing and what you might get out of each of them, whether they're applicable to you. So Tim Fuller is host of our brother show, Nucleus Investment Insights. He's also head of advice at Nucleus Wealth. He started his career as an engineer working in the West Australian mines before pivoting to financial advice and working for the likes of AMP Mercer, as well as a Melbourne boutique investment house. Tim saw the writing on the wall for the delivery of advice through technology and teamed up with Damien Klassen to bring us Nucleus Wealth. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hi, Shelley. Great to be on. Yeah, that's a terrific intro for me there. So I don't know if there's much more I need to add to that. Thank you.
No, I hope not. I hope I've got it all. We did our podcast together a few weeks ago for the main podcast, Investment Insights. And you were on the other side of the microphone then as you are today. Is it nice to be on the other side again?
A little bit of trepidation. Don't know fully what's going to come my way vis-a-vis questions, but it's nice to know that perhaps some of my guests feel that way about me. So anyway, we'll see how we go.
Indeed. Okay, so before we get started, just a few housekeeping things. If you haven't already, subscribe and click the notification bell to be notified when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And if you like what you're hearing, give us a like and help our show grow. Thank you. Okay, so as I said, the topic today is going to be the characteristics of superannuation investing to give you an idea of what might be the best structure for you to be investing your super through. Before I jump into that though, Tim, I was wondering if you might be able to share with us some insights from the financial journey you've had so far in your life and how you would define financial peace of mind.
Sure thing, Shelley. So I guess for me, like everybody, you sort of get guided by a couple of events perhaps that happened in your past. And for me, in the realm of financial advice, it sort of happened prior to being in financial advice when I was working in construction over in the Pilbara. So I was a young guy, just left university. You know, started off on terrific money, more than my mum and dad combined in my first year out of the blocks, which was fantastic. Still hold it over him occasionally, but the key thing was I didn't really know what to do with money. You know, so I went from pushing together money week to week to pay the rent at university to all of a sudden the floodgates were opened and life suddenly started to look a lot rosier. And so I went to seek advice. So I went to somebody who was reasonably well off, and which was my boss. And he referred me to his advisor over in Perth. The sad part of that was that I went in there obviously on a good income, but with, you know, not much saved. I was pretty good at spending money back then. And he turned around and said, well, look, you know, come back and talk to me when you've got, you know, $500,000 to invest, basically. And I was less than enamoured with that response, as you could probably imagine, because I kind of felt, well, how am I going to get to $500,000 if a professional doesn't help me? And I'm, you know, I'm clearly not going to be able to get there by myself at the rate that I'm partying and buying cars and doing all the rest of it. So that was sort of one little tipping point for me, which sort of resurfaced later on in life as I sort of headed down the financial advice path. So as you mentioned, jumped from engineering to financial advice in the early 2010s, the start of the 2010s, got qualled up and got into the industry. And then a big part of my push was then to solve the problem that I had back then when I first saw that advisor. And so a big part of that was obviously putting together something with Damien, obviously, Nucleus Wealth, which could solve that quite easily. And you know, there's some big problems in providing advice to lower balance clients, and certainly that's probably been exacerbated over the years, even while I've been in the industry, just with compliance and all the costs. And so using technology in a similar vein, and exactly what we've done at Nucleus Wealth, means that people can get good advice and they can get it cheaply, and you know, it can be very available through the online delivery method as well. So that's sort of a little bit of background there. Financial freedom, I think, was the other question.
Peace of mind.
Look, I think for most people, finances are hard. Like, you know, it's a bit of an enigma. It's very easy to see, you know, and we've got a barrage of inputs from, you know, social media and the news of super, super, super rich people. And it's almost like they're just off in the distance, right? And that's no good to anybody, because unless you're, you know, creating the next electric car or going to Mars or building the greatest piece of software or something like that, you know, how does that sort of information, or how do you know what to do going forward, the first couple of steps? And so that's where advice can be quite handy, right? It can give you some pointers, it can give you some tips. And I think a big part of, you know, this show here is we're going to be helping people and our listeners to actually start looking at those sort of baby steps that people can take. And it's really about that. It's about having a pathway, having a plan in front of you. Now, you know, obviously financial advice in its full form can do that, but also, you know, as your listeners will know, listening to podcasts and getting these little tidbits of information from people that are looking to help is another way that you can just start having those little steps forward that then build into big steps.
Mm-hmm.
A massive part of investment is compounding and actually getting started,
yep,
making that first dollar compound to, you know, the next one. And so, you know, in going back to peace of mind, I guess peace of mind is reflecting on the fact that you're actually doing something,
mm-hmm,
and you're not doing nothing. You're not leaving it till next week. You're kicking something off at the end of the show or at the end of the week. And, you know, you can be comfortable then, you're building off a base rather than starting at zero. So, yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more about the doing something.
Mm.
You know, the more that you know about what your situation is, the more empowered you are to actually manage it.
Absolutely.
So,
that's right.
I definitely know that for a long time I had my head in the sand about it to some degree. And when I stopped doing that and started taking stock of my situation, it was just a weight off my back to know, okay, this is where I'm at. This is what I can do. And these could be stretches, but I have choices now.
That's exactly right, you know, and look, we'll and maybe even, you know, segues into today's topic, but superannuation is a great example of that. Superannuation means nothing to people in the early days of their life,
mm-hmm,
and yet it means absolutely everything to a lot of people, if not most people, at the other end of their life. But the interesting part of that is that the work that you do in the early days is greatly magnified in the later stages. And if you talk to any 55, 60 year old, in the, you know, normally in my old, you know, obviously in the full-faced or face-to-face advice realm where I used to sit, you know, it was like, well, what could you ask your 20-year-old self? And they'd say, I'd be putting more into superannuation, you know,
yeah,
I'd be doing it now. And so that's, you know, perhaps a little bit of a segue in today's topic, but certainly, you know, it just reinforces the fact that, you know, doing something now is way better than having to do it in 10 years' time. You've got to work a lot harder. Yeah.
I love hearing that advice from you. I've heard it before. And sometimes when you tell the story, you'll explain how, you know, if you started doing just a little bit extra in your early 20s, when you get to your mid to late 30s, you can have a really sizable asset. And it can just be such a, you know, kind of confidence boost about your whole financial situation. So you don't even have to wait until you've retired to actually be getting benefits from that.
Well, that's right. And it builds, as you said before, it builds options. So if you've got, you know, something, and obviously first homes, obviously, or a home or a house, whether you're living in it or rent, or, you know, or investing in it, is a commonly trodden path. Sad that it's, you know, it's a much higher, you know, aspirational goal now than it probably was for our parents. But at the same time, you know, it's sort of something that most people see as a bit of a rite of passage. Once you sort of get there, a lot of people with buying properties, obviously there's a big impact to lifestyle. There's an impact in lifestyle in saving to get there, and then there's an impact in lifestyle in making mortgage repayments and doing all of that. That's called life. Your life adapts. You go, you know, you don't go to as many fancy restaurants. Yeah. You don't buy the new car, or, you know, holidays are sporadic. But then in 5 years' time, you've got an asset sitting there, and, you know, perhaps you can start.
And it does change.
That's right.
Like the first year or so, and obviously depends on everyone's situation, different. But I remember when I was lucky enough to purchase my place, I've just thought, oh my goodness, this is going to be like this for the next 30 years. But your situation changes, you know, and I admittedly have been super lucky that interest rates have been going down.
House prices have been going up, so it's helpful as well for people that are in. Yep.
But, you know, I would just say that it gets better, you know, and doing the hard work early, like you say, it can really pay off.
Absolutely.
Okay, enough of that. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Okay, jumping into today's topic. So I actually got the inspiration for this from an article you wrote back in 2017. So it's dated well, thank you.
Tastes like wine, not milk. That's always good to hear.
And so what you're talking about was the different structures that you can use to invest your super. So, for example, you could use a retail or industry fund. There'd be like you'd refer to that as a master trust, or there's IMAs, which would be more along your lines of SMSFs, and there are a couple of other ones. And then I just saw within that there are a number of characteristics that each individual need to decide where they wanted to be on the spectrum of each characteristic. And before they could decide which was the right structure for them. So I took away from that article how much control you want to have over your investment, how much transparency you want from your investment, what level of fees you're prepared to pay for it, what sort of, if any, advice you want from it, and whether or not you want to be invested in non-traditional asset classes. So in a minute, I'll get you to talk us through each of those ones, but have I missed anything there? Is there anything glaringly obvious that we should add to the list?
Oh, look, I think from a structuring point of view, it sort of rounds out what superannuation is. You know, it's, and I sort of start the article off by sort of saying that, you know, superannuation sort of, you know, it's a tax advantage trust structure that's built for retirement purposes, and so it comes in many different flavors, but more often than not, as much as the hype and the advertising and the spin and the feel, at the end of the day, it's just another investment account.
I love that point. There's so many different flavors of it, but once you take off the packaging, it's almost always the same thing underneath it.
Exactly,
and you know,
exactly,
they're incentivized
right.
For us to perceive that there's a difference.
Well, that's right. And you know, getting your segment marketing right is, unfortunately, it's a marketing must do, but at the same time, the product's probably largely vanilla underneath as well. That's right. So look, if you like, well, maybe we'll just quickly sort of skip through the various ones. So the Master Trust side of super is the preeminent superannuation account that everyone knows, I guess. So essentially, you know, most people have had them in the past or have got one now. They can take, you know, a number of different forms, predominantly industry funds, of course. And then following on from that, the retail funds, or what they call retail funds, where it's essentially, I guess loosely, just not an industry fund is probably the best definition, but bank funds and
for profit.
Yeah, that's right. And so they're quite, particularly the industry fund end of the master trust system, or part of the universe, is known for cheaper fees because they generally haven't got a profit margin attached to them, and they're quite big. You know, the industry funds have done a great job in getting into a pretty important end of the superannuation lifetime of clients, which is when people start with a job, and they'll often, if they don't have a super fund, they'll be given one from the various industry, vis-a-vis industry fund that they've come from, and that's the reason why most people have had them, you know, in their lives. I guess from there, though, you know, an industry fund, you can have an industry fund from the age of 18 and you know, and close it off at 88 if you wanted to. They're designed to fit the whole life cycle of the client. Or of anybody, I guess. But then, of course, you start then working through all the different flavours. So pros for industry funds for mine, they can be lower costs. Insurance can be, I guess, built out or offered in the fund quite easily, and they've got these thing called group policies. So if you don't know if you need insurance often when you're young, but, you know, it's sort of provided sort of automatically, and the group rates make it fairly cheap. And it's quite easy. You know, people have been accused in the past of getting signed up for an industry fund and then probably not opening it, not even opening their annual statement for 10 years. They've just got a drawer underneath the cutlery where they all just sit and get filed away or binned. The point of all that, though, is industry funds, I guess, they're a group model or a bulk model sort of design, aren't they? So they have normally, and for ease of use, I guess, is on one side of the coin. So they're designed to be very easy for people that aren't financially literate to be able to go, okay, well, I've got one of these. I don't know what it is, but it says that it's a growth thing and I want growth. Okay, so I'll go with the growth option or whatever's been selected or I've selected. What you then lose, though, is a degree of transparency over exactly what's in there. Mm-hmm. And that's often not a great thing. When things are going well, no one cares about transparency. You're making money, okay. In certain circumstances, I guess, an ethical concern. It's just when things start to get a bit rocky, that's often when people start looking for alternatives, because they're going, okay, it's going down. I get next to no information from my fund about how I'm invested. I get I've got very limited ranges of selections of different speed portfolios, I guess, or different, you know, risk portfolios. And I haven't really got anyone to speak to about it as well.
Yep.
Because their customer service is really perfunctory service there to do, you know, change names and bits and pieces. I shouldn't say that. A number of industry funds now, you know, they've got this sort of quasi-advice or advice light sort of phone-based advice as well. But really, you know, that's about as far as it goes.
I mean, part of the problem with the really large superannuation funds and transparency is how many assets each option can hold.
Mm.
So I guess that most of them are unit trust structures, right? So
yep.
You buy a unit in a pool of funds, and if the total value of the pool of funds goes up, your value of the unit goes up,
yep.
Right? And so those pools can hold hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of assets, like thousands. Tens of thousands.
And not only that, but often, you know, you'll have your sort of main asset classes, and then there'll be a series of managers sitting under that.
Yeah.
So it's sort of fund to fund. So, you know, if you actually got an answer, and in my experience, and I've worked for a private super fund in the past, and as an advisor, I had a sharp question come from a client about what was in their portfolio. So I said, "Don't worry, leave it with me. I'm on their side. I'll see if I can get some answers for them." Couldn't get any answers.
No.
It was simple. It was something simple. It was about coal seam gas being in their portfolio. They just wanted to know if it was in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that meant it was important to them, and they lived in a coal seam gas problematic area in northern New South Wales. So the point of all that was that, you know, the opaqueness failed the test at that point, and it's very similar in the industry fund sort of side of things as well. And so then I guess what it does is, you know, it creates a need, and private markets and, you know, markets in general are very good at fulfilling needs over time if it, you know, it's commercial. So that's where a number of the other options sort of then come into play. So quite often it's the reason why they actually exist, because they're solving a problem from, you know, the larger incumbents. And I guess that's where those more individual, and so you sort of mentioned before, so IMAs is an individually managed account. SMA, as you mentioned before, is a separately managed account. We can sort of cover off on these a little bit as well. But what they effectively are doing is they're unpeeling those layers of, you know, manager and the blending and the opaqueness, and it's getting back to actually being, you know, a more one-to-one relationship with the actual underlying investments. That's probably the way, you know, best way to put it. So quite often you find that that's where people will go. So, you know, a big step, I guess, and a lot of people know about SMSF, self-managed super funds. For mine, that's sort of a big jump in the other direction of the other end of the spectrum in terms of complexity, cost, and an oversight from an industry fund. But it's quite often where a lot of industry fund money goes, because they meet an accountant who speaks to recommends an advisor, and the advisor then recommends a self-managed super fund, pull the money out of an industry fund, and here's everything I can do for you.
I guess there, I just put out a bit of a warning that the administration of a self-managed super fund is not insignificant, right? So
absolutely.
I guess often people will employ accountants to do that for them.
That's right. So yeah, absolutely.
It's always a case of being aware of what is behind a recommendation.
Oh, that's right. Well, look, obviously, in one of the beauties of master trusts is you don't have to worry about superannuation law. There's a trustee, a big overarching trustee that looks after the whole pool of, tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, and their job is to make sure they're on the right side of the mm-hmm. superannuation yep. Various acts and regulations. When you jump out across to self-managed land, without help, you are effectively taking charge of saying, okay, I'll look after I'll look after all of the compliance and all the bits and pieces to maintain it. Because if you do something wrong in self-managed super land and you break what's effectively the code or the SysAct, then you're in what's called in breach. And once you're in breach, all of the tax advantageous pieces of superannuation start getting taken away from you, unless you can unwind it and be very very apologetic to the ATO. Yeah. And so there's some of the risks, and because there's risk there, then that's where people then start hiring professionals to manage it for them, and that can come obviously at a cost. And so they're sort of the two edges of the spectrum. And then there sort of sits a number of sort of options in the middle from a structuring point of view. The two principal ones, I guess, and I've mentioned them in the article, is this sort of wrap platform. So they still sit in super. You don't have to worry about the trustee stuff, but you do get more direct visibility and transparency over what you hold. Yep. And then there's the other model, which is the one we use, which is separately managed accounts. So it's still a platform base, but it takes away a lot of the management sort of side of it. So you can give it to a manager like ourselves. I can use this as an example. We'll do the investment piece day to day. You don't have to worry about stocks and trades, but what you do get is a lot of customization and the ability to have a lot of visibility and transparency in the portfolio. And if you see something in there you don't like, then you can knock it out or do something to remove it. And likewise, in terms of getting risk profiling and all that. And so that's sort of what sort of sits as sort of piggy in the middle between, the industry or master trust land and self-managed super funds. I think I hope I've covered off on most of the areas in my...
I think you have. So... let's just circle back on control. So, how do you define control in terms of your superannuation investment?
Yeah, sure. So, look, I guess you've sort of got a couple of key elements, haven't you? So, control comes from working out. Well, principally, and this you've got to put this at number one every day of the week is your own risk appetite, time frame for investment, and the amount of risk or growth assets is another way of putting it that you've got in your portfolio going forward. So a big part of that is having an interface with the product, I guess, in a way, whether it be industry fund or self-managed super fund or whatever. So you've got a good, firm, confident grip that where your money, your long-term lifetime savings is being invested is actually being reflected on your position and your own personal circumstances. So that's a must-have across the board. Lightly done, I think, at the industry fund land, really seriously done at the self-managed super fund land, but there's varying degrees of cost as well, And I hasten to say that you can always get personal financial advice on an industry fund, and they've got a big advice groups there. I know several of them. So going back to that sort of control piece, so... the risk profiling, number one. So you've just got to make sure that whatever you're in, you're comfortable.
It's what's right for you.
That's been done, and it's been done well, and you understand it is the other big piece. Because if you don't understand things, you lose sleep at night, and that's not
So
not
when
an
you
idea.
Say you understand it, what level of understanding do you have to have?
Yeah, but I'd say at least comfortable in the process would probably be, and then what the outcome is, so that if you've gone through a very commonly used tool in advice is the risk profile, and it covers off, and you can do risk profiling a number of ways. We do it online. But, you know, in a face-to-face environment, it's sort of tying in, you know, probably more through conversation than an actual tick and flick box exercise, you know, with a suitably experienced advisor. But the idea is that you then, there's some thought put into, I guess, the final makeup of a portfolio. Now, keeping in mind that portfolios are built on today's time frame or today's answers or today's situation, and situations can change, and so you've got to, you know, retain the ability to make changes going forward. You get closer to retirement, your time frame for investment gets shorter, so you need to make sure that you've got that, you know, that ability built in. And then it's really, I guess, once that big rock of risk profiling and having that sort
of
ownership.
So if you're listening now, if you have superannuation, you feel like you're not comfortable that you're in the right one, the right product given your risk profile and time frame and that sort of thing, what can you do? And you can't afford to go and see a financial advisor.
Look, I think probably the main bit there is, if I look at it from a practical sense, you need to reach out to the product provider or whoever your super fund and see what they've got for you. That's probably your first point of call. See whether or not what you're in is going to get the job done before you start canvassing other options and going down that path. And more often than not, they should have something there. Now, it might get the job done. It might not. It might be a bit light on. Building then off that piece is about going, okay, well, if I'm not comfortable with the solutions that are, you know, that are available, then I need to go and look elsewhere. And then that's where, I guess, the work can begin. So you then need to go, okay, well, you know, what am I actually looking for in the product that I'm looking at? And so when you meant before, what you said before about comfortable, I guess comfortability can take a number of forms. So there's the raw risk profiling piece where you just feel that we've been through a particularly volatile period in the last 12 to 14 months. And how have you felt about the volatility? You know, has that actually worried you? Hopefully by now you've probably gone and seen whether or not you can do something about it in your current product, but maybe we can use this this podcast to empower you to go out and check that out. So going forward from there.
But I guess as well, just jumping in there, I guess you can be uncomfortable with the volatility that your portfolio might have had, but you still need to question whether or not that's the right thing for you. Because, I mean, if you have 40 years left that your superannuation is going to sit there and growing, then you probably do want to have a bit of risk that...
Absolutely.
And so you kind of maybe need to think in that situation, oh, maybe I just need to get used to hopefully not minus 35% in 2 weeks, but a bit of the ups and the downs because the trend is going to be up overall.
Yep. Well, absolutely. And look, the comfort can come from doing, you know, a risk profiling exercise or getting a recommendation or, you know, doing a limited advice piece or whatever it is. And you might actually find that the result is to remain where you are.
Yep.
But the degree of comfort is then going, okay, well, I've done the exercise and I've got my result now. You know, I may have never done one of these in the past, or I may have done one a long time ago. And it was sort of something similar we were saying to our clients, go in and revisit the risk profile because they may have been, you know, with us for 3 years. Life can change, markets can change, or, you know, there's a lot of moving parts in the background. And going in and revisiting, it just gives you a bit of affirmative action that you've taken some action.
So that's the second thing, like re-engaged. Just because you did one, two, three, 10 years ago doesn't mean that you don't have to do another one.
Well, that's right. You know, and it's crucial, and, you know, it's part of a a full service advice relationship. The risk profiling piece, you know, is done, you know, half yearly, depending on sort of what the situation requires, for exactly that reason, because, you know, mindful of the fact that life is life, things change, and feelings towards volatility can change once you've been through a particularly volatile period as well. You may want to temper that a little bit, but I guess so that from a comfort perspective, that's sort of the risk profiling piece. And then there's probably essentially, and then sort of just leading down in sort of an ethical path perhaps as well, you know, and once again, people's ethics can change. They can learn things about the way the world works, and they can learn things about the way they don't want the world, you know, directions they don't want the world to head in. And then a degree of discomfort can come into how you're invested, because you didn't, you know, when you got the, you know, got the superannuation 5 years ago, you didn't feel the same way. That can be a little bit harder to solve perhaps inside an existing product, but there's certainly a lot more ethical options available. So it's worthwhile at least assessing what they've got in that regard, and whether or not it's going to meet up with your newfound ethics or the ethics that you're wanting to push going forward.
I suppose on that point, to the point of there being so many options available, there are really varied. So you can't just sort of now say, oh, it's ethics, so therefore it must be X, Y, Z. They all have, the idea is differentiation and nuance between them all. So
it is.
It's hard work, but it's worth it.
Well, that's right. And ethics is it's a broad church. And one of the sad parts about it is it's also brought in a lot of people going, oh, okay, we're ethical as well, and doing this thing called greenwashing, where any product can be ethical. You've just got to spin it in the right way.
Yeah.
And once again, if you're not in finance and you're not prepared to read through the fine print of the investment option, it can be pretty hard. And Absolutely. If there's a certain super fun ethical fund, then you go, okay, well, it's got to be better than their other ones, and off you go. But you don't really know what lies beneath the surface. Different approaches, once again, in the ethical space. There's a number of ethical advisors, financial advisors, whose job is to go through, measure up your ethics, and then build portfolios or recommend products that, yep. that will fit the bill. I guess we sort of sit somewhere in the middle at Nucleus, where we offer 30 plus different ethical screens, and people can go in and actually pick apart and actually zero in on exactly what they want. Yep. The way it works practically with ours is it deletes stocks out of the portfolio that don't match the ethics, so it's a negative screening approach, and we feel that it's a slightly more customizable, certainly more tailored solution. So rather than just getting 20 or 30 of them ticked automatically in a broad ethical fund, you're able to pick the ones that mean the most to you and leave off the ones that you're ambivalent about. So that's sort of how we do it. But look, there's lots of different options and markets and, yep. And products out there as well. So
okay, yeah, I think you've done a great job covering control. Thank you. And maybe the last one, the characteristic that I want to focus on a little bit, because we haven't touched on it that much, is non-traditional asset classes.
Yes.
So what are non-traditional asset classes?
Well, without it turning into one of Damo's podcasts. So look, the non-traditional asset classes, so once again, pretty broad realm, essentially. If we go, maybe it's better to talk about the traditional ones and then say everything's everything else.
Sure.
Variants of cash, high quality bonds and defensive assets, I guess, on the defensive side, and then equity or shares is and then there's infrastructure and other things as well, I guess, that can sort of sit somewhat in there. And I say that because a lot of industry funds dive into infrastructure.
They do, that's true, and real estate.
Yeah, exactly, and they're not they're certainly not poor investments. They're just investments that are generally quite big, lumpy. What they call illiquid.
Yeah. What is illiquid for those that don't know?
Yeah, sure. So illiquidity is just essentially your inability to sell until a certain period of time.
Yeah.
Housing, for example, is not a very liquid option. You can't, in comparison to shares, markets, shares are on market every day of the week.
24 hours, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
Your house currencies, might take 3 months.
That's right. There's a big process. When you're building a hospital, you can't, build the first wing of it and then decide that you need to sell a chunk off, sort of thing. It's the way that I work. But then it's important to build in, and once again, without diving too much into the investment sort of side, but with higher levels of illiquidity, you generally demand a higher level of return.
Sure.
And so that's why infrastructure, when you're a big fund, for example, can be a salient choice, I think, in picking, because you've got a big block of money that you're just never going to need to sell down for a certain period of time, and so you can allocate it to those. Where it gets a little bit interesting is, and we saw it in sort of March and April of last year, we had sort of this planets aligning of culmination of different factors. So you had a big market shakeout, you had people shifting into cash in the industry, speaking to a couple of industry funds who had some trouble. And then you also had the inclusion of the $10,000 superannuation payouts that people were able to take out of their super. So huge, big cash demands were made on large funds, which actually then started to show that the illiquid parts of their portfolio were starting to become a bit of a problem, I guess, in a way, because they were really having to reallocate, and to the point where some of the major funds locked up the ability for clients to move from a growth style portfolio, which would have quite a lot of illiquid assets, and it was the money was put into that sort of bucket because it was a long term investment, and so I think it was prudently invested. But people thought that if I put it in growth today and I want to take it out in 2 weeks' time, I should be able to do that. And more often than not, you can. When you get a period like we saw in March and April, market sees up and they've got, you know, big cash withdrawals and they've got to pay out money and all the rest of it, then they start lowering the members' ability to move around inside the fund. And a lot of people weren't happy with that, as you could probably imagine. So these are sort of some of the things that only, I guess, in severe market duress, you know, the problems sort of, you know, suddenly pop up from beneath the surface in, you know, in some of the investment models.
Yeah.
That being said, you know, depending on, and this is something that, you know, people need to think about going forward, is, okay, well, is that going to be a problem for me? Do I want to have that sort of issue? You know, is that going to form one of my, you know, items on my laundry list of things that I don't want to have, you know, in a new product or something that I'm having a look at as well? It was an interesting time, I think. And I'd like to think that perhaps their risk management models are going to help prevent that in the past, but, you know, in the future rather. But it's difficult to say, you know, big infrastructure around.
I wonder if it's more a matter of the messaging that they give to people going forward. Like, I mean, you really think that expectations should have been set post the GFC, global financial crisis, in 2008, because it's exactly the same thing that happened.
Yep.
I feel like it's such a short time ago. Doesn't really justify them having lost that the memory of that incident, but I guess that's what happens.
Oh, excuse me. Absolutely. The at the same time, one of the big problems that and particularly when you've got hundreds of billions of dollars to invest, and, you know, look, it's a great problem to have, but at the same time, it's a pretty big problem, is you start running out of things to buy.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
And reaching into illiquid assets and funding airports and hospitals and all the rest of it are good news stories. You know, it's nation-building
stuff. And they're big. If you're struggling to put money away, a lot of money away somewhere, an infrastructure asset, it costs billions and billions of dollars.
It does.
And you're like, I've successfully allocated that amount of money.
There you go. I don't have to worry about that. Yeah, that's right. You know, there's something off my to-do list. Unfortunately, the flip side is that, you know, when things lock up, you can't get the money back. Half-built airport's no good to anybody. So you're not going to be able to sell it and liquidate it to get back to your members.
Yeah. Mm. Alrighty. So I think we've covered them all. Thank you so much for your time today. I'm going to put up a slide now showing, because we've jumped all over the place a little bit, but we'll map, the slide maps the superannuation structures against the characteristics that we've discussed today. So you can have a look at that and see of those characteristics, what is important to you? How much control do you think that you want in your superannuation? How much transparency, what level of fees, advice, and whether or not you want to be in non-traditional asset classes, and then get an idea of what sort of structures you might suit you. And hopefully there's something from that table and discussion that we had today that can help you maybe take a look at your financial situation from a different point of view and bring something fresh to it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so before I say goodbye for today, if you have any feedback for me about this episode or any ideas for future podcast topics, please let me know in the YouTube comment section or send me an email at contact@nucleuswealth.com. And if you'd like to see more of Nucleus Wealth content, you can head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. And from nucleuswealth.com, you can also subscribe to our newsletters if you'd like to hear more from us on an ongoing basis. If you know anyone who you think would get something out of today's episode, let them know about it. Share it with your friends, colleagues, and family, and help our show grow. And thanks so much for tuning in to me today and Tim Fuller to hear our thoughts on our first podcast for Nucleus Wealth Empower.
Excellent. Good on you, Shelley. Great to be on.
Thanks, Tim. Bye.